Thanks, Jerry, for inviting me to come out this evening. And so, as he has said, I have a very confused accent. And my church is kind of used to listening to me now, so always when I'm somewhere else, try to enunciate my words, speak a little bit slower. No matter where I go, people ask me where I'm from. And so I grew up in Scotland, but even when I go back to Scotland, they ask me, where are you from? You'll sound like you're from here. And so I... first 10 years of my life, grew up in southeast England, and then we moved up to Aberdeen, Scotland, lived there until I was 23, and then moved to Washington, D.C. to do an internship at Capitol Hill Baptist Church, and then came to Louisville to come to Southern Seminary and to go to Bible college. Always thinking I'll just be here for 3 years and then go home to Scotland to plant a church there, but I'm still here. Some 15 years later, and so here I am. But the Lord in his providence had us about 6 years ago launch a church planting ministry to Scotland called 20 Schemes. So just in his kindness, I feel like the ministry that I have in Scotland today is far greater in scope than it would have been if I'd gone back when I wanted to go back 10 years ago or so. So yeah, I am pastoring a church in Bardstown, Kentucky. And so it has whiskey and golf, so I feel right at home. In many ways, and planted Redeemer Fellowship Church, and it's in many ways been a hard place to do ministry, a very Catholic heritage in that community, but by God's grace we've seen a church come alive, and it's been just one of the joys of my life is to pastor and shepherd that church. So that's my main job, is to be a pastor of Redeemer Fellowship Church. That's my first love. But beyond that, these two other ministries, one is called 20 Schemes. So when you think of the word scheme, you think of some devious plan. But a scheme in Scotland is not a devious plan. A scheme in Scotland is literally a community. And so you may use words like projects, social housing. That's kind of what a scheme would be. It's a little bit different. Scotland, most of Scotland's cities, the inner city of Scotland would have, where the most of the poor would have lived, but up until about the Industrial Revolution, and then the poor were moved out of the cities and purpose-built communities were built around industry. So coal mines, textile mills, shipbuilding yards. So purpose-built houses were built around industry, and these were called housing schemes. But what happened is the industry collapsed, often in the 70s, 80s, 90s, those manufacturing industries collapsed, which left these kind of ghettos of poverty. And about 40% of Scotland's population would live on a housing scheme, so it's almost half of our country lives on these housing schemes. But what you typically will not find in a scheme in Scotland would be a gospel-preaching church. Most of Christianity in Scotland, it's about 3% of Scotland's population will be Christian. I don't remember meeting a Christian until I was well into my teenage years. About 3% would be Christian, but Christianity in Scotland has been reduced to this middle-class bubble. And so where the poor live is where you don't tend to find Christians. And so 6 years ago, we launched this ministry, church planting ministry, to see churches planted and established in these communities, the schemes of Scotland. Our goal is to see 20 planted, and that'll be a catalyst to see a church planting movement across the poorest areas of Scotland. And so today we have 7 sites. 3 churches have launched, and we've got 7 church planting teams right across Scotland. So I'd love to share with you more at some point about the work we're doing in Scotland, and maybe even have you come and join us in Scotland at some point as well. But then off the back of that, we realized that some of the things that we're talking about, church planting in poor communities, not many other people are talking about this thing. When we talk about ministry to the poor, often we think of, what do we think of? We think of starting a food pantry or some kind of mercy ministry, a homeless shelter. We don't think of starting churches. And that's really my main point of this first session today, is what the poor need more than anything else is a healthy gospel preaching church that is committed to making disciples and raising up leaders from the very community that they're trying to reach. And so we realize that this is not just a problem unique to Scotland. This is a global problem that whether I'm in the slums of Nairobi or the townships of Johannesburg or the favelas of Rio de Janeiro or some of the poorest communities here in Kentucky, that is still the problem, is that our poorest communities need gospel preaching healthy churches that are raising up leaders from within those communities. That's why we launched a year ago now this initiative called Church in Hard Places, which is a church planting ministry seeking to train and develop church planting teams to go into poor communities, but also seeking to raise up leaders from those communities to disciple them and train them to be evangelists and pastors in those communities. So you can find out more about that at churchinhardplaces.com. So we're going to talk about two things. What is poverty? In our first session, we're going to try to have a biblical understanding of poverty. And then after our break, we'll come back and seek to have a biblical understanding of addictions. So you can't talk about poverty without talking about addictions, particularly here in Kentucky. And so I want us hopefully tonight just to touch on some of those things. Like Jerry said, these are big topics that we're trying to wrestle with here. But let's just kind of at least give us a biblical framework to think about issues of poverty and issues of addictions. And so when we think of poverty, when I say poverty, what comes to mind? This is going to be quite interactive. I'm not preaching a sermon here. It's more like a workshop. And so when I ask a question, it's not rhetorical. I expect some answers. So when I say poverty, what does poverty mean? When you describe something who's poor. What's that?
No money.
Yep, so the most obvious answer is, we just sung that, didn't we? When I have no money, king or peasant comes to reveal the glory. So we think about money, a lack of money. What else?
Education.
So a lack of access to good education. Healthcare. Yep, access to good, solid health services. Food. Yeah, so perhaps lack access to food. Jobs, housing, employment. So you think of all these answers we're given. When we think of poverty, so the word lack is obviously always there. It's a lack of something. But our understanding of poverty tends to be about material things. A lack of good housing, a lack of good hospitals, a lack of good schooling, a lack of access to food or certainly nutritious food. And so we think of poverty as a lack of something, of some kind of a material possession. But here's what's interesting. The World Bank did a study of 60 poor countries, some of the poorest countries on earth. And it asked the question, what is poverty? And here's some of the answers that those who grow up in some of the poorest places on earth gave. So somebody in Moldova said this: for a poor person, everything is terrible. Illness, humiliation, shame. Somebody in Guinea said, I feel ashamed when I stand before my family. I have nothing to feed them. In Latvia, we cannot afford to invite anybody into our home. We feel uncomfortable visiting others without taking a present. We feel unhappy. Uganda, when one is poor, she has no say in public. She feels inferior, like she doesn't matter. Vietnam, I will always be poor. There is no hope. It's interesting, when you ask somebody who grows up in an area of poverty, they tend not to describe their experience based on a lack of access to something. They describe their experience by a feeling that they have. Often it's about a sense of shame, a sense of being marginalized, a sense of being looked down upon, like they don't count, like they're somehow less significant. They describe their feelings, not so much their wants. They describe how their sense of guilt or shame. And I think that's true no matter where you are. So all these descriptions we gave is from Africa, from Europe, and I think it's from Asia. But I think it's going to be true even here in Shelbyville. It's going to be true certainly in Nelson County, in Louisville. When you ask somebody who grows up in an area of poverty, describe what it means to you to be called poor or to live in poverty, I think they would describe their experience of poverty based on how they are made to feel. This idea of an oppressed people, an oppressor, being held down, held back, misunderstood. Here in our own area, you know, the government defines poverty based on median household income. And so there's a poverty threshold. And if you dip below that threshold, then you are considered poor. What's that threshold? Well, poverty households living in poverty in Louisville, the median household income for those living in poverty is $11,000 a year. In fact, 1 in 5 kids in Louisville are growing up in poverty, living in homes, bringing in just less than $11,000 or $12,000 a year. But the reality is that in our country, in certainly in our area, those that are living in poverty are actually working. These are hardworking poor people. They often have a job. You know, in some places around the world, poverty is because of unemployment. And that's not necessarily true in our area. Poverty tends to be because they're just not getting a living wage. And yet they're made to live in poverty. And even when they work, they feel like they can never get ahead. And it's not like they have a lack to a good school, a lack of access to a good school. I just can't get ahead. You know, there's a sense of shame. So it's important, before we begin even thinking about how do we as a church think about addressing issues of poverty in our own community, it's important that we have a good understanding of what poverty is. And there's a few books for you to think about as a good resource. When Helping Hurts by Brian Fickett. A lot of things that we're sharing today are principles that are coming out of that book. And then also Church in Hard Places. It's a good title. Should name a ministry after it. By Mes McConnell and Mike McKinley. Those two books, I think, if you read those two books together, they give you a good framework for doing ministry to reach poor communities or to do ministry or evangelism outreach to the poor, even here in the community here. Why is it important, though, if you're a good understanding of what poverty is? Because based on your understanding of what poverty is determines what your response to poverty will be. And so if you think that poverty is caused by a lack of access to good education, then your response to poverty would be to provide education. If you think that poverty is caused by a lack of access to money or resources, then your response would be to try to create some sense of resources to respond to that problem. But poverty, if we understand poverty to be less about a lack of access to material things, but actually poverty is deeper than that, then it should affect our response to areas of poverty in our own communities. The problem is that many of us are responding to poverty and social issues in a way that actually isn't helping the real need that people in poor communities feel. You take somebody in a homeless shelter. You give them a bed to sleep at night. They still feel poor. Give them a meal to eat. Or they still feel hungry and living in poverty. Now, the bed and the meal doesn't solve the deeper issues that people growing up and living in poverty sense and feel. In fact, one of the things that we're going to unpack here is it could actually add to that sense of shame and guilt and marginalization. The problems in our areas are not going to be solved easily. They're not going to be solved by a 2-week mission trip, going to a place to try to alleviate poverty in a certain community. You know, you think about when you go and see a doctor. A doctor can make one of two mistakes when he's treating us. The first mistake, he can misdiagnose you. And if he misdiagnoses you, then he's going to end up treating the wrong problem. And oftentimes, when we think of how the church is responding to poverty, it's treating the wrong problem based on a misdiagnosis of what poverty is. Another problem that a doctor can make is it can offer the wrong solution. And the cure that it provides, that the doctor offers, ends up hurting more than it helps. What we need then is a biblical framework for poverty before we can think through how to respond to it. So there are four foundational relationships that we have. So when we're thinking of building this foundation, this framework for what poverty is, it is really based on these four foundational relationships that we all have or were created to have. First relationship is our relationship with God. That we were created to have a relationship with God. That's our primary calling. We exist to glorify God, to make much of Him forever. Our second relationship is our relationship with ourselves, that we are made in God's image, that we are not evolved beasts, we are image bearers of the Almighty God, and yet some of us, all of us, because of the fall, that relationship is broken. The third relationship is our relationship with other people. We're built, we're created to exist in community with others, to have loving relationships with one another. And the fourth is our relationship to creation itself. We're called to be good stewards. So we're created to have these four relationships of God, self, others, creation. But what happened at the fall, as a result of the fall, when sin entered into the world, when sin entered into Eden, was that all these relationships were broken. And for the first time, mankind became poor. For the first time, mankind in the garden became poor because in that moment, his relationship with God is broken. His relationship with his self, his understanding of who he is, his relationship with others, there's now enmity, there's strife, and this relationship with creation was broken, was destroyed. You see, poverty is the result of relationships that do not work, that are not just, that are not for life, that are not harmonious or enjoyable. Poverty, more than anything, is a lack of peace. It's these relationships are broken and it causes a lack of peace in all these relationships. My relationship with God, my relationship with my community, my relationship with myself, my relationship with just eating, just food, or home, or where I rest at night. All these things become broken by sin, by sin. So poverty then is not just a single issue problem. And it's not going to have a single issue solution. If we are poor, it's because we lack harmony in all these areas in our life, which means if that's true, then that is true for everybody. See, all those things I just said about poverty is true for all of us, that we all have a broken relationship with God, we have a broken relationship with self, a broken relationship with each other, and a broken relationship with creation, which means that at its root, if that's what poverty is, then all of us, no matter whether you're middle class and living in an affluent home in a gated community or living in a trailer, all of us experience that sense of brokenness. And so we're going to first recognize if that is true, then poverty is not you are broken and I have what it takes to fix you. Which in many ways, that's how we view our approach to poverty. Is that we go to broken people because we have what it takes to fix what is broken in their life. Food, housing, shelter, education. But that's not how we understand poverty to be, according to Scripture. So how does the way our churches respond to poverty actually add to this sense of brokenness? If poverty is really about, really summed up more by brokenness, not so much by lack. So we think it's better to use the term poverty as essentially about brokenness. Something is broken. It's not by a lack of something, because if you just provide that lack, it doesn't actually change the fact that there's still a brokenness there. Still a brokenness in their relationships with their self, with creation, and ultimately with God. Much of the work that we do in economically deprived areas is based on a faulty understanding of what poverty is and how we need to tackle it. We need to completely rethink everything in terms of our response to poverty. Well, my goal today is really for us to challenge the way we think about ministries of mercy, social justice, some of the things that kind of, in many ways, cool and trendy and hip in a lot of churches today. You know, you hear terms like mercy ministry or generous justice, and it's built, though, on a faulty understanding of what poverty is. In fact, in many ways, it just perpetuates the problem. We are hurting more than we are helping. In the international aid community, so there's an earthquake this week in Indonesia. I don't know if you may have seen some of the pictures on the news. I watch the BBC news just so I can see what's going on outside America. And so when I watch the BBC and there's pictures of this horrendous earthquake in Indonesia this week, what's the first response when there's a human tragedy like that? First response, what happens after a crisis like that? Send aid. Yeah, so it's called, so the first step is relief. And so the tsunami that hit Thailand, relief, the earthquake that hit Haiti, first step, right, is you send in relief workers, aid workers, to come in and just deal with the crisis. So the first step of international development is relief. In a situation requiring relief, the materially poor are truly unable to help themselves. They're completely unable to help themselves. They need, desperately need help. They need aid. Relief, though, is only appropriate in those situations after an immediate crisis. Otherwise, if you don't provide relief, there's going to be a downward spiral. And there's going to be complete chaos, death. The people can't help themselves in that situation. They will die. Crisis is imminent. They need immediate relief to respond to that crisis going on. But you don't stay in relief mode forever, right? And so after a few months of relief, what's the next step? Rebuild. So rehabilitation. So you come in first and you provide relief. You stop the flood. You pump out the waters. You provide emergency aid to those who are literally dying on the streets. But now we need to start rebuilding what is broken. We need to start building infrastructure. We're no longer in the crisis mode. Now we're moving into rehabilitation mode. That could take a long time, right? Rehabilitation can take many places years to get them built back up again where they're in a sustainable infrastructure again. But once you've got it built and you've rebuilt the sense of infrastructure in that community, what's the next step? What does long-term international aid look like? It's called development. International development. That point is about shoring up the structures that have been built. It's about helping to maintain them. It's about educating teachers and doctors and nurses and construction workers so that they themselves can maintain what's been built in the infrastructure in that community. Now, if after this earthquake in Indonesia this week, if all we provided was relief, and then 10 years later, there's still relief workers, then what's happening? We're not providing any help at all to that immediate crisis, to that situation. Now, we see that in some countries. So you go to places like Haiti today, and it's still in relief mode because it's failing to really think through these issues about development and rehabilitation. It gets stuck. A lot of ministries get stuck in relief mode. But I want us to think about, it's actually the same thing is true whether you're talking about a natural disaster as whether you're talking about a personal disaster in someone's life. That when people enter into a place of poverty and real genuine brokenness, their first need is often for relief. There's a real problem. There's a crisis. And so we have in Bardstown a downtown counseling center called the New Life Center. And in many ways, its first point is to be a place of crisis intervention. Somebody who is hungry, somebody who is homeless, somebody who is perhaps struggling to keep their kids, they have a point of crisis. They come into contact with that ministry because of their crises. And most of our ministries of mercy, we're in that relief mode, right? Somebody is hungry, let's provide a food. Somebody needs a place to sleep, let's provide a bed for them to sleep on. Somebody is needs access to medical help, let's provide some free dental care or whatever. We do relief mode. But our contention is that most churches' understanding of poverty relief ends at relief. We have no plan for rehabilitation and development. We're just content just to keep doing relief work. And so all of our ministries to the poor is just relief work. Again and again and again, and we just get stuck there because we have no plan beyond it. Many Christians, if we're honest, we don't recognize the distinction between relief and rehabilitation. We just get stuck. We give handouts to low-income people who seem incapable of helping themselves, yet the reality is they're totally capable of helping themselves. In fact, us helping them in that way just feeds them, just traps them in that place of incapacity because we continue to provide their handouts. Churches and ministries contribute to the materially poor's sense of shame and incapacity. That's the problem when you get stuck in relief mode. So we're not saying here, don't respond to people's immediate needs. We're saying respond to people's immediate needs, but that's not enough. Don't stop at that point of need. Have a plan for moving beyond that to rehabilitation. Another word for rehabilitation, in terms of, if you think about mercy ministry being crisis intervention, the next word is really discipleship. We need a plan from getting from the place of crisis to a place of discipleship. of really walking alongside somebody, seeing them develop and grow and begin to take some responsibility for their own lives and where they're at. One of the things that we would say as a ministry is there's nothing more depressing than a regular at a soup kitchen. And yet most of our food banks and soup kitchens are designed to keep people coming back. In fact, we even celebrate that. You know, we've served this many meals this year. Or, you know, this person, he comes every day and he gets lunch every day and we think that's a good thing. That's not a good thing. We're stuck in relief mode and we keep providing relief again and again and again and we're not actually moving this person from relief to rehabilitation. Look, our job as Christians, as churches, is not to alleviate poverty. And Jesus said, the poor, you'll always have with you. Our job is, our goal out there is not poverty alleviation. Our motivation for doing ministries of mercy is not to alleviate poverty. Our motivation has to be, if we recognize that poverty at its core is just brokenness, our motivation is this, is that you are broken, I am broken, and we both have the same solution to our brokenness, and his name is Jesus. That is through a relationship with Jesus Christ that will deal with your sense of shame, the feeling of guilt, inadequacy, marginalization. Those things are all the descriptions, those descriptors of poverty that those who experience poverty describe. All of that, the gospel is the response to it. Now, that doesn't mean that we're callous to people's real needs. We do crisis intervention through mercy ministry, but it can't stop there. Our confidence and our motivation is the gospel and the glory of Christ. Mercy ministry and social justice can end up being nothing more than an opportunity, if we're honest, to update our Instagram feed and make us feel better about ourselves. That we can think that we as a church are making an impact on our community because somehow we did this food drive or we started this shelter. The way we do ministry to the poor, or even the way we do international missions sometimes, really is it thought through beyond that moment of ministry, that point of crisis intervention. We rarely have a plan for long-term development. You know, we can paint a school, we can plant a community garden, but unless we have a meaningful, thought-out plan for an evangelistic ministry that develops into a disciple-making ministry, we have done nothing. We've done nothing. And yet, sadly, too many churches and Christians, if we're honest, we become a hindrance, not a help. You see, much of our ministries to the poor are nothing more than a paternalistic outreach, often wrapped up in the guise of a successful ministry. And these ministries are almost designed to go on in perpetuity. And that's just, it's just wrong. If these ministries are designed just to keep people trapped where they're at, then we're actually hurting, not helping, in the way we're responding to people in real needs. But here's the problem, if we're honest. Relief is easy. Rehabilitation is a whole lot harder. Relief is cheap. Rehabilitation is a whole lot more costly. Crisis intervention, we can all do that. We can all pick up a paintbrush. We can all serve a meal. But you invite somebody who's really trapped in addiction or poverty or real hardship, and you invite them into your life, there's a cost that some of us are just not willing to pay. But it's that cost that leads from crisis to rehabilitation. It's staggering but true that many churches just haven't thought through how we're going to generally help somebody from, you know, really, when you think about doing ministry, let's say a soup kitchen. So have you really thought through, we're going to go to, you know, the inner city mission and we're going to serve a meal. Have you really thought through what it looks like then to disciple the person you're serving the meal to? Have you really thought through what it looks like to develop a friendship and a relationship with that person? To really thought through what it looks like to get involved in the chaos of that man or woman's life? How many people have you seen go from soup kitchen to an elder in a local church? That's the pathway from relief to development. That we believe that the gospel calls us to. That if every man, woman, and child is made in the image of God, then we've got to believe that if our true issue of poverty is one of brokenness in terms of our relationship with God first, and then as a result of that, our relationship with all these, with self and creation and others, then if the gospel restores what is broken, then it's possible for that man or woman to be restored fully in all those relationships. Many Christians have, if we're honest, spoken and perhaps unspoken prejudices against working with people in poor communities. And we've got to be careful about that. There's prejudice, whether that is along racial lines, but I don't think it's usually that in many of our cases, but sometimes we're honest. We just have a prejudice about the way people look, the way they dress, the way they smell, the way they talk to their children. And there's a sense where we create an us and them. And we think that really we just need to clean them up. And until they look like and act like us, we're not really going to invite them into our homes, into our churches even. We don't really have a whole lot of expectations of them. Much of our outreach to the poor is often hindered by that sense of unspoken prejudice that we have. You know what's sad is that, you know, you think of Louisville, you think of most counties in Kentucky, there are poor everywhere. There's always poor people. There's people living in poverty. In rural Kentucky, poverty is not as seen, it's not as visible. And so it's like Jerry was saying, so we started a homeless ministry in Bardstown, and most of the guys that would stay or girls that stay in our church building who are classified as homeless, they've been living as couch surfers. You know, so they're not the kind of the homeless beggars on a street. They just sleep in their car or they stay in someone's house on a couch. They're still homeless. But in rural Kentucky, there's real homelessness. We just don't see it. It's not as visible. It's not as obvious to us. But most of us, particularly us Reformed people, us Reformed evangelical, gospel-loving, gospel-believing Christians, if we're honest, we've abandoned the poor to parachurch ministries and to theological wolves. You know where you're most likely to find heretical churches pop up? It's in the poorest parts of our cities. People peddling a false gospel, and we're just content to let it happen. Now, to see churches peddling a prosperity gospel, a false gospel, a liberal gospel, no gospel at all. Or we're content just to fund the parachurch ministry. You know, the shelter, the food pantry, the whatever it is. And we just think that that's how we'll do ministry to the poor. And yet if our commission is to go and make disciples, it's going to take more than a parachurch ministry to see disciples made in poor communities. It's going to take healthy gospel-preaching churches. And that's why it comes right back around to our conviction that when the poor need more than anything else is a healthy gospel-preaching church. And Christians who are in healthy gospel-preaching churches, developing relationships and friendships, and inviting people into their life and into their church. You see, the local church is always the solution. It's never the problem. It's always the solution. If it's God's will that the poor and the marginalized should be recipients of His love and His salvation, then the normal way by which God demonstrates His love and His mercy to anybody is through the witness of a local healthy church. The normal way that poor people will hear of the gospel is through the witness of a local healthy church. Then we as churches should be investing ourselves, not so much pumping millions of dollars into mercy ministries, but committing ourselves to diverting that money into developing healthy churches and seeing churches grow and flourish in poor communities. The most effective ministry you can do to the west end of Louisville is to find a healthy church and get alongside it. To get alongside a pastor who's struggling. And to encourage that church and to see it come alive and thrive and strong. That's how you see relief become rehabilitation in a poor community. We have to have a rock solid confidence in the gospel of Jesus Christ and have a complete commitment to this conviction that what all broken people need more than anything is a relationship with Jesus. You see, the church is a ministry of mercy. The church doesn't do mercy ministry. The church is a mercy ministry. The way that we demonstrate love and compassion towards one another, that we invite people to come and sit around our table and eat with us, that we demonstrate genuine affection and compassion towards those in need and crisis, that is done most effectively is in the life of a local church. It's the mission that we have as Christians. There was a Canadian anti-poverty activist. His name is Nick Saul. And he caused a bit of a stir by this statement. He said this about food banks. So this is a Canadian anti-poverty activist. He's not a Christian, but he said this about food banks. Food banks are essentially privileged people helping the underprivileged and perpetuating an us and them atmosphere. You know the one thing that breaks down that us and them atmosphere in a poor community is a church, not a food bank. The food, he goes on to say, the food they provide is often poor quality and the process does nothing to help clients' dignity or self-esteem. It doesn't help them get a job. It doesn't help them get out of poverty. It doesn't improve their health or their well-being. People's immediate hunger may be satisfied, but that doesn't last long. Here is the haunting commentary on most food banks. The only person who is not benefiting is the person it was set up to help in the first place. Most people who have to visit a food bank say it is a slow, painful death of their soul. That's counterintuitive to us. That's not a Christian saying that. That's not a reformed kind of hard-nosed guy who's just saying that about mercy ministry. That's somebody who's an anti-poverty fighter, somebody who is waging war against poverty in Canada. He's the one who says that. A lot of our ministries are a slow, painful death to the soul. You know why? It's because if we examine most of our mercy ministries, rarely is it done in the context of true, meaningful relationship. In fact, most of our mercy ministries are transactional, not relational. And so it's about handing a child a jacket or a mother a meal. Rarely is it about getting to know the name of that child and his story and being a part of his life or that mother's life and getting to know her story. The one thing about doing ministry amongst the poor is that I love about church planting in poor communities is that people who grow up in poverty, they love to tell you their story. They love to tell you their story because it's really the only thing they have. You know, in a middle-class context, what's the first thing you do when you meet someone new? Say, what's your name and what do you do? See, we define each other based on what we do. Your job defines you. And a poor community is really about what you do. It's what's your story. Where you're from. Where'd you grow up? It's more about who you know, not what you know. People who grow up in poor communities, they love to tell their story. Their story is a sense of value. It gives them a sense of worth, a sense of dignity. And yet, if our ministries are built on a foundation of transaction, not relationship, then it's actually about silencing their story. The most effective means that we can do in ministering to the poor is about just getting to know a man's story, a woman's story, a kid's story, and getting to tell them your story. How once you were broken. How once all your relationships were broken, unsatisfied, miserable. And yet now, because of your relationship with Jesus Christ, you found true peace and true joy. It's not because you got a degree. It's not because you got a certain kind of promotion. It's not because you moved from one end of town to another end of town. It's because you met Jesus. You know, the gospel is a great equalizer. I can sit and eat with a homeless person And I can say to him and to me that we are both made in the image of God. And we're both broken without him. And this meal won't fix you. And I can't fix you. So don't put your hope in this place. Put your hope in Jesus. And the best place to find him is to come to a local church. And so come with me to my church. You know, if we examine our ministries, if we examine the way we've even thought about reaching the poor, rarely is it built on the context of relationships. We started this homeless ministry in Bardstown, like I said, and so it's a transitional emergency housing. So we have cots in our fellowship hall, and we'll set them up, and we serve a meal, and then we set up these cots, and they just come, and usually in the winter, and they've had a hard day out in the cold. All these guys have jobs. Everybody that stays at this place has a job. They don't have a place to live. They can't afford rent. They can't afford a deposit. Or they've been kicked out by their girlfriend or the result of a divorce or whatever. They've all got some kind of mental health issue or an addiction. There's a reason. Everybody's got a story. But the reason why we started this ministry is not so that we can just provide another bed for them to sleep. No, the main reason why we started it is so we can invite them into our building and we can sit and have dinner with them. And we just get to hear their story. And so each night they come back and we ask them, how's your day today? We want them to feel like this is their home and we're guests in their home, sitting around the table with them. You know, that's far more impactful than simply providing a place to sleep at night. Let me give you some, we're going to wrap this up with some principles about how to do this well. All right, so we've kind of touched on some of the problem, corrected some of our faulty thinking about poverty. Hopefully we've got a better understanding what poverty is. Let's give some basic principles. If we're going to build a healthy church that is doing ministry well in a poor community, then here's some foundational principles to think about. Number one, this is how you build something from crisis to rehabilitation. Give new converts responsibility quickly. When you see someone profess faith, come to faith in an area of poverty, sometimes our tendency is to kind of, we're always kind of weary, right? And so, you know, the way they look, the way they dress, you know, they're tatted up, they've got no teeth, there's real problems going in their life. If we're planting a church in a poor community, one thing I want to be able to do is give this person responsibility very quickly. And it may not be anything. It may just be, you know, serving in a fellowship hall, serving a meal. I want to give them some sense of dignity, some sense of worth, some sense of value to us. The very thing that none other organization wants to give them. And so we're going to involve them very quickly. You know the other reason? Is because if the poor are going to be reached, it's not going to be me that reached them. It's going to be him. I want to empower him or her to go and be the evangelist to the very people that he or she has connections with in the very community we're trying to reach. And so first thing is, when you do see somebody come to faith, profess faith, yeah, I mean, don't be wise, be discerning. You know, the other thing I notice about people who are converted out of poverty, particularly those who struggle with addictions, they can be very fast learners. You know, actually, they tend to be very curious. They text you all the time, questions about everything. They just like they discovered something new and they're just pouring themselves into it. Now, the people in my church I can't get to read are the university-educated guys. The people I can get to read are the people who've got no education. They'll read with me. Now, the people I really have a hard time getting to read in my church are the more middle-class guys who just don't want to read. They just want to scroll through their Facebook feed or whatever. But these guys, I can get to sit and read a book with me. You know why? Because they value the relationship. They treasure that. This is new to them. All right, so give them responsibility quickly. Secondly, make sure that you're communicating in culturally sensitive ways. We may think that we all speak the same language, but there is a huge culture gap between somebody growing up in poverty and somebody who grows up in a middle-class community. A culture gap is often revealed in our vocabulary, our dress, what we listen to, what we value. But we've got to recognize that this ministry is It's cross-cultural. And so we need to make sure that we're communicating in a culturally sensitive way. And so whether you're doing a ministry in the west end of the city, or whether you're doing ministry in the schemes of Scotland, don't presume that you're communicating in a way that people are understanding. Be sensitive to how you're speaking, what you're saying, the questions you're asking. You see, without knowing it, we can end up perpetuating a paternalism, a sense of paternalism. You know, paternalistically, we end up having a sense of not only resource paternalism, which is, you know, resource paternalism is the idea I have, you don't, so I'm going to come in and give you something that I have that you don't, so that you know that I have it, you don't, and so it kind of perpetuates a sense of shame. But there's also a knowledge paternalism. This idea that you need me to teach you these things, and there's nothing you can teach me. Now, take time to sit and learn. Now, if you're going to be effective engaging people in poor communities, and sit down and learn from them. Try to learn how to communicate. It's how to communicate well. 3, be prepared for failure. And one of the most discouraging things about doing ministry amongst the poor is watching people walk away or fall back into habits of sin that have been lifelong struggles. And it can seem so destructive. And we feel like we've just invested so much in this relationship and they just kind of walk away from it so quickly. The reality is, though, that, you know, it's for somebody to change and adapt to life in Christ, it's a long-term journey. Now, all of us struggle with sins. Who of us in this room is still not struggling with the very same sins that we struggled with the day we were converted? Just some sins are more obvious, more messy, perhaps more destructive than yours. We've just got to have at least an ability to embrace failure and realize that even though they've walked away, I'm not going to give up on them. For some, they may just walk away and we'll never see them again, and there's certainly the expectation that will happen. But just because somebody crashes and burns doesn't mean that we give up. We just press on. We press on. We continue to call them to faith and repentance. 4, look for unlikely leaders. I think sometimes we have an idea of what a leader in our church should look like, and that often betrays our own prejudices. Somebody should speak with a certain accent, or they should act in a certain way or dress a certain way, and that's the kind of person that we will kind of invest in as a potential leader. The other thing I learned about a lot of guys who are converted out of communities of poverty, these guys not only learn fast, they've got some leadership skills. They've got survival skills. They're willing to take risks. You know, the most cautious people I know are Reformed Christians. And the very people who trust in the sovereignty of God, the very people who believe and celebrate the sovereignty of God, we're the most cautious people I know. Now, if we truly believe in the sovereignty of God, then we should be bold and courageous in our ministries. So be prepared to invest in the unlikely leaders. Maybe he's never going to get accepted to Southern Seminary because he's got a criminal record, because of his past. Does that disqualify him from serving in leadership in a local church if he's now converted and growing in grace? No. And so we make sure that we're investing and trusting in what God's doing in a man's life. They don't just follow a certain pattern of what we understand to be normal Christian behavior. 5, treat this ministry as cross-cultural ministry. When we do ministry overseas, and we recognize we're going to cross a culture to go overseas. So if you're doing a mission trip to Guatemala, then you've got a different language to learn. You've got a different culture to embrace. There's culture shock. I can guarantee it, in this city and other cities in Kentucky, you can cross a street and cross a culture. And if you're going to enter into another culture, then our job is not to kind of convert that culture into our culture. That's not our job. We wouldn't do that in the mission field. And so why do we think we can do it in our own cities? Rather, it's about learning that culture, understanding that culture, seeing if there are elements of that culture that can actually be used for God's glory, elements that we can learn from. So treat it as cross-cultural ministry. The next, establish multicultural teams. So if it's cross-cultural ministry, then if we're going to be effective at reaching that part of our city that is a different culture to this church, then I need to be seeing if my church leadership is representing the various cultures of my city. Now that's not a requirement, but it's certainly the best way you're going to reach other cultures in your city, is raising up and training leaders from the other culture to reach them. And so to all the leaders in your church, have the same education, the same background, the same kind of job. Or is there genuinely a multicultural look to your leadership? Now, in North America, there's obviously a racial component to that. You cannot ignore that in North America. Anywhere else in the world that I give this talk, now I was just given this workshop a couple of weeks ago in New Zealand, and a week before that in Australia. You know, there's just different cultural flashpoints in every city. So in New Zealand, it's about the Maori population, and in Australia, most people in poverty in Australia are the indigenous people in Australia. So when you think about poverty, they have to think of the indigenous communities in Sydney or in Melbourne. So there's obviously cultural lessons we've got to learn, but we've got to make sure that we're recognizing those cultural challenges in our own city, in our own communities. Which means the next principle: be aware of your own personal prejudices. Few of us will admit in this room that we have prejudices. But if we're honest, we have cultural biases. That we would look at something that, and because it reflects our culture, our upbringing, our tradition, we elevate it. We elevate it saying, well, that is better than this. And so we need to try to get people to that. But is what we're calling people to the gospel, or is it cultural? Are we calling people to gospel transformation or cultural transformation? Now, one often leads to the other. But don't presuppose it. And so in some communities, we've got to leave our biases behind, our prejudices behind, about how people spend their time, how people communicate, what kind of music people listen to, how people dress. And finally, if we're going to do this kind of ministry, we need to be honest about the cost. We need to be honest about the cost. If you're going to set out to reach the poor, then you've got to recognize that it's not cheap. Now, I'm not just talking about financially. There's a cost involved. The reason why we get stuck in relief mode, we never move to rehabilitation, is because relief is cheap. But there's a cost involved in development and rehabilitation. Relationships are costly. Investing my time is costly. You know, it's easy to write a check to the homeless shelter in town and feel like our church cares for the poor in our own city. It's much more costly to spend my time investing in a relationship that's actually going to drain me every day. I mean, every day I get the same messages. It's like they're around me all the time. You know, one thing about people in poor communities, often if a lot of them have more time, which means, and they don't follow a schedule. You know, we like our neat little schedules. You know, come to, you know, Wednesday night Bible study, come to Sunday morning prayer meeting, come to church 11, that's how we do discipleship. You know, people growing up in poverty, they don't have that kind of rhythm. You know, 9 to 5, evenings off, weekends free. Most people growing up in poverty, particularly in rural Kentucky, they're hardworking. They work shift jobs. They don't have that kind of same rhythm that we have. Often, in fact, some of the hardest working people I know are those earning the least in my church. which means I've got to sacrifice my time and my schedule and my routine to get alongside them. And that's costly. Are you willing to pay that price? Relationally, it's costly. I'm pouring myself. It's emotionally, it's draining to walk alongside an addict. You know, if you ever done ministry with an addict, then you know just how exhausting it is, spiritually, emotionally, physically, if your time, and financially is costly. This isn't cheap. You need to examine your heart. But understand this. If our motivation is right, if our motivation is Christ and His glory, then we'll press on in this work. You see, we have to examine our hearts and know that where we're prone to selfishness or indifference, where we're prone to apathy, we have to be on guard against pride, against a desire to earn our salvation through good works. We also need to consider our own service in light of our wider work in the local church. But in the end, we need to consider this. Discipleship is always costly. There's always a price to pay. But how best can we invest our lives in Christ's kingdom? How best can we consider the rewards of this ministry? You see, our motivation is not because we love the poor. That's a really faulty motivation. I don't do this ministry because I love the poor. I do this ministry because Jesus is worthy of their worship. Jesus is worthy of their worship. And that's our motivation. That's what presses us into the hard places. That's what keeps us there. It's what keeps us there when people walk away. It's what keeps us there when the cost seems so high. Christ is worthy of worship. And if we don't go, who else will? It's up to Christ and His church. It's up to the church of Jesus Christ to go and preach the gospel to those who do not know Him, that they might bow the knee to King Jesus. That's what motivates us. That's what keeps us going. We love the poor because more than anything, we love Jesus. We believe in this ministry because we believe in Him. We have confidence to press on because our confidence is in Him and in Him alone. And I've just touched on a lot of issues there. And maybe later we can kind of push in or push against some of those things, but that's just kind of a broad scope of just kind of at least kind of ask some questions about some of the misconceptions related to our own ministry to the poor. But let's kind of stop there and take a break, and then we'll come back.